we finally moved back into the house after 4 months of living with my in-laws.
Oh, thank God.
The good news is we've moved back in. The bad news is that the contractors still aren't done finishing work on the house. The governor issued restrictions on work and who could be out and all that stuff. We're just a few steps away from shelter in place at this point. But it was coming right down to the last thing. So the first floor needed to be painted. There was some lights that needed to be installed, electrical outlet covers, stuff like that. We were really getting close. And then, of course, coronavirus hit and the governor did what he had to do and basically shut down all the contractors. So we told him, we said, listen, we're moving back in. We're living with our in-laws. Scared about, it's already too late. If somebody gave it to somebody,
late. But going forward, if you can keep your 70-year-old in-laws from interacting with teens and with you guys that are going out into the world, how much better? Yeah.
And not only that, but if somebody does come down with symptoms, there's no way to isolate that person
in a one-bedroom condo. Where do you go? God.
We were getting right down to brass tacks. So I called my contractor. I said, we're moving in. You're either done with the house or you're not. And if you're not, you're just going to have to work around us from that point on because we're moving in. So I call my movers. Now, Riley and Sons Moving and Storage here in Philadelphia. We found out about them through our in-laws. They used them to move in and just fell in love with these guys. All of them right out of Central Casting. If you want somebody to represent the fantastic country of Ireland, if you want to represent Irish Americans, Central Casting, you go right to Riley Brothers, Riley and Son Moving and Storage. They were wonderful, and my mother-in-law just fell in love with these guys. Was giving them big hugs and everything, and you're such a nice guy, and these skinny little
guys. Giving
them
big hugs. See you, mother-in-law. See you. You're not too old to appreciate a big Irish hug. I get it.
And she was like, not the
Let
big.
Let me
like,
just she's, give you one more hug.
she was enamored with the skinny little one that could lift big things. She's never imagined this little skinny guy. He could lift a piano. He was amazing. So when it came time
Brad,
for us to
move.
There's
a lot of fantasies involved with that. I just want a man that can big lift my thing.
and these guys were just eating it right up, So when it came time to move, I immediately called these folks because when you find somebody who's good, you stick with them. So this is me literally yesterday, Monday, moving in. We've got to move the hell out of the condo. At the same time, we'd come over to check the house out. The water heater had been left off purposefully for 4 months. And when I tried to get it going again, it had given up the ghost. And also on Monday, my wife was starting work from home from her work. We needed to get Verizon to come in and install internet a week before. Then, as soon as they installed it, I had to take it apart and put it in a cupboard because I thought there was still going to be workers walking around, and I didn't have furniture. They were going to step on this modem or the paint fumes the guy warned me about. So, on Monday, I'm supervising the movers. There's plumbers over putting a new hot water heater in.
Okay.
The internet is borked. I set it back up, not working for beans. just nothing is working at all.
Oh.
And I get a call, fraud alert on my wife's debit card.
Oh my God.
Literally, all of these things are happening at
Meanwhile,
the exact
Meanwhile, a pandemic
same
is also
time.
Raging outside in Philadelphia. Yes. So there we go.
And I'm literally, the room is spinning. It's like there's just too many things going on. And the only thing that got me through was Riley, these guys, these happy Irish guys carrying stuff on. And within the first three armloads, they knew all my family by name. So they'd bring in a box, and he says, this go to Alex's room? I go, yeah, yeah, that goes to Alex's room. He knows right where Alex's room is. Is this in Max's room? Yeah, yeah, this is Max. This is Max. Yeah, no problem. They're bringing in chest of drawers. Does this go to Alex's room? And I go, yeah. And he goes, Alex already has a chest of drawers. I'm going to take that into Max's room. I go, okay, yeah, yeah, you're right. These guys are hysterical, happy as can be. And as soon as the boxes of comic books start coming in, two of them are big comic book nerds. So we start talking about comics and what was great about the 80s and the 90s and comics and what they've seen and what they collected and all this stuff. I got a Tank Girl number one. The one guy paid for his dad's heart operation with a 1960s Spider-Man book that he had been holding.
Wow. Wow.
And he said, you know, he said it kind of made me sad to give it up. He says, when you think about it, that's like a get out of jail free card. I bought that for less than a dollar. And to be able to pay my dad's medical expenses with something I bought for less than a dollar, I was almost happy to do it.
Oh my God, I love that you hired my Irish cousins in Philadelphia to come move you in. Brendan, Seamus, yeah. Aiden, come on, yeah. We're going to go move in the Geiger family, right? Everybody grab a box. All right, so this goes in Alex's room, right, okay. Yeah. And this exactly chest of drawers, is that for your man there? Okay, right. Well, this is a box of films, old VHS and DVDs. Where would you like us to set this box down? Right, toe-to-toe. Okay.
And by the way, I haven't moved a whole lot. Like we've lived in this place for 20 years.
Wow.
So I don't know whether you're going to have to tell me. They sat, not only did they bring like the dining room table in three pieces, but then they sat there and assembled it for me, which would have taken me hours because I'm not good at this stuff. The bookcases they came in, assembled them. Everything that they brought in, that got brought in parts, they sat there and put it back together for me. Even though it might have taken them like an extra 20 minutes because they know how to use tools. Me, I would have been banging this thing like a chimpanzee with a rock, you know.
Well, see, that's an Irish tradition. So it's an Irish tradition that once you move into a house, you have to have a surface to set your beer down on. So they would not have left that house with you without a surface. That's bad luck by any stretch of the imagination. So,
Oh my God,
that's great though that I'm really happy that they were nice and kind and I'm sure in true Brad Geiger tradition, you gave them a firm pat on the back and a wave out the door.
No, and said,
each "Thanks of those... so much, everybody. I've been Brad Geiger."
No, I learned my lesson. Each one of those MFers got a $20 bill and an elbow bump, a firm elbow bump.
Good man. I got to tell you, Brad, as a friend, I have been legitimately worried, and you can tell the world this. I've been so worried about you moving back in for like the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Because you can see the writing on the wall of where this pandemic is going. And I was like, get in your house. I think I texted you one time at like 1 a.m. I'm like, Brad, just have the builders finish one bathroom. You can hot plate it. You can hot plate it and microwave it. You don't need a working kitchen. Just get one bathroom working and get back in that house.
Yeah.
And you didn't respond to that text because I think you were like, all right, David, bring it down a notch.
No, I have this bat. Well, what happens is for the last week and a half, I've been waking up at 3 a.m.
Oh, God.
In the cold sweat where you wake up in a panic. And so then, you know, of course, I get up and go to the bathroom because I'm an old man. I come back and then I can't get back to sleep. So I start reading through stuff like Twitter and my texts, but I'm too sleepy and groggy to respond. So then, like, I read texts and then forget about it by the time I fall asleep again and wake up in the morning. So I wake up having missed half the stuff that I've read.
Oh, that's true. But regardless, you are now in your house, which makes me so happy. It's an infinitely better place to ride out a quarantining city in your own home with everybody has a room. Bathrooms are working and you're not stepping over 70 and 80-year-old in-laws.
Listen, Dave. We finally got everybody's in their own room. We've got all one of the things we did. Everybody's got new doors and these beautiful white doors with the little paneling on them. Everybody, Max goes into his room, shuts the door, click, clink. Alex goes into his room, shuts the door, click, clink. My wife and I walk into our bedroom and we shut the door, thunk. What the fuck? Thunk, thunk. The door's not hung right. We've got the one door in the whole house that doesn't fucking shut.
Brad, at this point, take it. You have a house again. Just take it. You get what you get and you don't get upset, Brad Geiger. You get what you get and you don't get upset. You're in your own house.
I wasn't getting anything until that door shut.
Well, we're not going to end on a better note than that. So I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, Brad. We got a lot of stuff on today's show. We're going to be joined by Carl Kerschel of Abominable Charles Christopher and Isola. But before we do that, I want to give a huge shout out and thank you to our sponsors this week over at Wacom, WACOM.com, and the makers of the new Wacom One. They have kindly lent to Brad and I to try out, and boy, have they been lovely to use. They are lightweight. They are easy to use. They are, frankly, as fully functional as you could want for a Wacom for that price point of $400. And boy, howdy, have I been enjoying mine.
I got to tell you, Dave, two things. Number one, if you're ever sheltering in place for 4 months with your in-laws and there's not a lot of room, you want a small, portable, well-built tablet that you can walk around and find a little corner of the apartment and work in, number one. But number two, this came up just last week. So, of course, you know, everybody's talking. We've got circles of friends. One of my friends is a teacher, and all teachers now are doing remote learning, distance learning, right? And she's a math teacher. And she's like, hey, Brad, I need a tablet that I can use so that I can use it kind of like a whiteboard for my students.
And I'm trying
to do this on my computer with the mouse. It's just not working. I need something affordable, but it's also got to be good. I've got to be able to plug it in, make it work, and let it rip, because everything else is upside down in everybody's life. You know, the first thing I pointed her towards, I said, listen, the price point is right there and you're never going to regret it. Get a Wacom One. You're going to be able to use it just like you use your whiteboard. You're going to set it up. You're going to have it running in minutes, and you're never going to regret it. It's going to be a great purchase. She's been using it now for a week and absolutely loves it.
That's, you know what, how nice that we've been able to pass that along to people who in this weird quarantining moment can use it to teach. That's great.
Yeah.
So anyway, a big shout out and a thank you to our friends over at Wacom at WACOM.com and the new Wacom One. It is a fantastic jump-in price point for pros, pro-ams, and amateurs at the $400 price point. And Bradley J. Geiger, jump us into the first question today, my friend.
Oh, I've got such a good question for you. This one comes in from one of our $5 Patreon backers. This is Angela who wrote us. And Angela says, hello, Brad and Dave. If I work at an unpredictable schedule, taking months off from personal comics to work on paying comics and other freelance, should I wait until my graphic novel is complete before I start posting it online? Or can I post what I have and then take an undetermined break, even as long as 6 months? Or should I break it into issues, in this case, 4 issues around 25 pages each? So Angela's talking about an unpredictable schedule that might take her off her comic to work on other things to bring the money in, which is super important these days, might be as much as 6 months before she gets back to that comic of hers. What do you advise for Angela?
Well, this is first of all, Angela, what a great place to be in, that you have working comics taking you away from personal comics, right? Like that's, of all the situations in the world to be in, that is a nice one to be in. So congratulations on that. It's good to see that even, and I say that because A, income is lovely. We all can agree on that. Income is lovely. But also, how nice to have a paying project that is also still training you, keeping you doing new things in comics so that when you come back to your comic, you have increased your skill set. So just as a baseline, how lovely is that, right? So congratulations. Yeah. Secondly, I think, frankly, this is a can't lose situation. If you are able to keep going, as Brad says, one of the greatest hallmarks of success is, are you still doing it?
Yeah.
And whether you decide to go the 6 month off, 6 month on, or whether you do one big installment where it's all out, frankly, it's a win situation. It means you completed a project. You were able to get through it and get through it with a weird schedule. So I'm leaning towards either one is fine as long as you can make it work for you to get the project done. Brad, what are your thoughts? Let's get your initial thoughts first.
Dave's exactly right. And I'll tell you why. Because again, in the immortal words of Papa Smurf, I'm going to say this until I'm blue in the face.
I will leave this podcast right now. I will take these headphones off. I will leave this podcast right now. In the immortal words of God bless America. I'm angry at that one.
I love to see you so worked up over that. That's wonderful. That feeds my soul. I'm telling you. I keep saying it, and I'm gonna keep saying it. These aren't the webcomics 1.0 and webcomics 2.0 days where it was very much ad-driven. We're into, if you're going to follow that nomenclature, we're well into webcomics 3.0, the crowdfunding time and the social media publishing time. And it's no longer tantamount to your survival to be putting this thing out on a regular schedule.
Right.
If the work is good, you can put it out on an intermittent schedule and be just fine. And especially something like a long form, you can use that latest update to point people towards where they can read the completed book or the ongoing chapter somewhere. You can point them towards ebooks. You can do all kinds of things. If your work is good, if your work is compelling, I don't think you have to worry quite so much about schedule and just keep your eyes laser focused on quality.
Yeah.
The only thing I will say is that 6 months makes me a little bit nervous. If it's stretching on to 6 months, that might be that might be expecting a little bit much. And then maybe you do want to group those issues up, like you said, in the last part of your question, where you kind of release them on 25-page episodes and stuff like that. That I could see. If it's stretching on to 6 months, yeah, go ahead and do that. But other than that, I wouldn't get too upset about schedule. I'd keep your eyes laser-focused on quality.
Right. And I'm going to amend my earlier answer because as I've had time, Brad's great answer gave me a second to think about other possibilities, which one of the things that Brad and I often advocate is draw it once, but get paid for it multiple ways,
yes.
Right? So what we mean by that is when you draw a page for this story, ideally, you'd love to be able to sell the individual page either as original art or as a print, right? That's one way.
Yeah.
And then as you're creating them and releasing them piecemeal, they get Patreon support, right? That's the second way. And then when you go to collect the book, you kickstart it, and that's the third way, like Brad's doing at newevilbook.com and that I'm doing at storylineshow.com, right?
Nicely
so
done.
Work that in. So that's the third way. And then the fourth way is you then have that physical product to continue to sell either in future Kickstarters as add-ons or at comic conventions or on your own store down the road, right? So that's the fourth way. So that one page that you've drawn ideally has been part and parcel of four or five or six different transactions. Over the course of those years, right? And so what I'm getting at here is if you are currently ahead, right, like you've done the 6 months and they're ready to be released, Brad and I might advocate for releasing them piecemeal and setting up a Patreon around them.
Yeah.
Because then you can take advantage of that second one that I mentioned, which is you have the individual pages for sale. The individual pages can also contribute to Patreon backing. Then you collect it to a Kickstarter, right? So you get what I'm saying is
right.
If you are ahead right now, maybe dribble drabble them out into the world. Dribble drabble being the scientific term. Dribble drabble them out into the world. I thought that would get a laugh out of Brad. And that's
all
a courtesy laugh for everyone at home. I know Brad well enough.
All I can picture is drabble from that syndicated comic strip. And what would be making him dribble? I'm not quite sure. But
a dribble drabble. He needs to go see his urologist.
that's something you want to get checked out.
Yeah,
immediately.
Exactly. He's been hanging out with the parrot too much. Anyway, that joke is unlike me. All right, I'm going to leave that alone.
Yeah.
So anyway, what I'm saying is you might want to consider if you are ahead or if you could potentially be ahead in the future, maybe dribble those. God damn it. Now, maybe trickle. I can't say trickle either. Maybe slowly release the offer.
Boy.
God, everything sounds terrible now. Jeez Louise. You know what I'm saying. Maybe put out one page at a time have the Patreon around and I'm going to stop talking. Brad, go.
Nothing wrong with using an idiom like putting out. But, you know.
Jeez.
So listen, you've made a great point. You made a really good point, and I think we can button it up there. But here's the deal. Angela has been a longtime Patreon backer, and what she's done is she actually submitted like four different questions, each in the separate month of when she was a backer. And I just want to mention this because you mentioned originals, and one of her questions was about using old originals. So right. as a quick way of kind of continuing this conversation and also killing two birds with one stone, let me read you her quick question about originals, because I think we can address that under this overbranching topic.
Okay.
Angela says, I have a large backlog of original art, and I have no idea what to do with it. I don't have a fan base that would snap it up like you guys do. Should I just hang it onto it for when I do and then sell it on eBay? Should I toss it? Should I put it in a portfolio and take it to shows where people can buy it? I cannot judge if it is something people would want someday. So you mentioned original art. Give Angela some advice on what they can be doing with their original art.
Okay, so Angela, my advice is everything that you mentioned except throw it away.
Yes.
It is incredibly small spaced when you stack them up and put them in a drawer or put them on a shelf, right? Yeah. They don't take up a lot of space. Do not throw them away. That is a mistake you will regret.
Yes.
I have 4,000 originals and they take up only a small space in my place. In a fireproof safe. And here's the thing. Will you want to sell them eventually? Yes, absolutely. Will you want to sell them at shows? Absolutely. Will you want to sell them on an Etsy shop or on eBay sales? Absolutely. You can do all of the above.
Yes.
And the thing is, their value doesn't decrease as your readership grows. It increases as your readership grows. People will want that one special page. People will want the first time the character appeared. Even if in your mind you're like, they don't look as good as I draw them now, right?
Exactly.
In your mind, you're thinking that. Yeah. For a reader, they're like, this is their first appearance. This is the first time they talk to that character. Oh, right. I love this particular joke. There's 1,000 reasons why people would want this or that individual page. I can speak to that, having sold, I don't know how many pieces of original art strips. But keep them. Sell them, trickle them out slowly, or do it all at once, however you like. But you will regret not having them. It is a great source of supplemental, sometimes not even all that supplemental, sometimes a significant chunk of your income to have those original arts. Brad, that's my thought. What are your thoughts on that?
And the only thing I want to, I'm going to co-sign everything you said and just mention that it's got nothing to do with having a large or a smaller audience. In other words, I think if you actually counted my audience, it wouldn't be as large as you're thinking it is. In fact, I know it's not as large as you're thinking it is. But
things Brad seriously. Said on his wedding night.
Yeah, I'm going to leave that one alone. The thing about it is that I could never sell originals. Like, I tried all of those things. I took them to shows. Nobody wanted them. I lowered the price. Nobody wanted them. I put them on eBay. Nobody wanted them. I sold them on my website. Nobody wanted them. What happened is I offered them as Patreon rewards. And all of a sudden I'm sending them out every month. I'm sending a stack of them out every month, as Patreon rewards. And it's one of those things I don't really advise a super lot. I kind of do it and it's tricky, but it's like at the $20 level, you get an original every third consecutive pledge. So it's basically at the $60 level, but they're doing it in $20 installments. I sent a stack of them out every month. I couldn't sell them. I'm literally at conventions, I couldn't give them away. But as Patreon rewards, holy smokes, they're fantastic. And you're going to want, as your career gets rolling and as you go along the line, you're going to want some of those upper tier Patreon rewards.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
How nice it will be to have a big stack of them sitting there that you can just, you know, page through and here's a secret if you're going to do that. Don't give them a choice. Give them a little choice. Give them a little choice. But if you're going to go down to, you know, if you can say, listen, if you know exactly the page you want and exactly the day, that's great. You can't guarantee it because it might not be in stock, but you can do that. But what I do with mine is I say, tell me the name of your favorite character. I'll send you an original with that character on it.
That's nice.
That's good for almost everybody. And if they want something specific, I'll work with them. But 9 chances out of 10, they like just having their favorite character on it, or you could say favorite theme or subject matter, whatever. But then I choose it. It's a lot quicker, a lot easier for me to fulfill these rewards, and everybody's happy. So yep. That's a little bit of advice I've got for original art on Patreon.
And my capstone on Brad's capstone is this. It's implied in Brad's answer, but in addition to Patreon giveaways, you can also make your upper tier Kickstarter levels have original art in it too. And
yeah.
So the ways you can use this, Angela, are manifold as you go forward in your career. And so don't throw them away. At the very least, store them. If you don't think you can sell them now, there will come a time, as Brad and I are telling you, where you can make good use of them in your career. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics. Well, Brad, the little red light is blinking, which means it's time for our special guest. And what a special guest we have today, our delightful friend from Points Up North, Carl Kershaw. Carl, thank you for coming on to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. Third time's a charm.
Third time is a charm. So, Carl, you know, from my longtime favorite, Abominable Charles Christopher, that can be seen over at abominable.cc. Or the of recent years, the most beautiful book I've seen on the market, Isola, at isola.ca. Isola is a fantastically beautiful book from Image Comics, and we'll be talking about that today. But Carl, first of all, how are you doing? I'm sure you're in quarantine like the rest of us. How are things holding up, my friend?
Things are okay. Everyone's kind of, well, I think it's been, 4 days now? Tuesday now? Friday? Schools were shut down. I stopped going to the studio. My wife's working from home. So now it's just like, it's just a matter of balancing work with kids running around. So
yes. You stopped going to the studio. Do you share a studio with other people?
Yeah, I used to. I've been sharing a studio here in Montreal with a bunch of people for several years. And then when I moved to Japan last year, I gave it up. And then upon returning, rented a new space with some other. So now I'm renting space with some indie game developers and a couple other comics people.
Wow, like very cool. I saw photos of your space, by the way, and it looked gorgeous, like filled with light, big, beautiful, industrial-ish looking space.
Yeah, it's all, the only downside of this space is that it's, we have no elevator. We were in an industrial space before, and so now if I'm getting a pallets of books delivered, I'm kind of screwed because I can't. I have to just haul them up a bunch of stairs because we're on the second floor above a retailer space.
So I was gonna make a joke like, well, it's not hard to haul a Wacom pencil up 4 flights of stairs, but it is hard for books. You're right about that.
Yeah. Tons of books.
Well, just out of curiosity, this wasn't a question I was planning to ask you, but why not ask it? For someone that's looking to find studio space, any tips or suggestions on how you did it, both in terms of finding roommates and in finding the studio itself?
Well, I like to offload those responsibilities to other people. So, what happened was...
You've just described my career with Brad. Yeah. I let Brad make all the hard decisions, and then I just go, yeah, that sounds good, coach.
This is my whole life. This is my marriage, my career, everything. I just kind of float through life doing the stuff that inspires me and hope that things work out. what happened was my first studio, I had friends here in Montreal who were... starting a space and just invited me. And then I was there for probably 10 years. And in this space, these game guys were sort of, because we've done a bunch of work for Ubisoft, who is right around the corner mm-hmm. from us. And they left Ubisoft to form their own company and asked if we wanted to join the space, partly because they needed people to help with rent and partly to just sort of cross-pollinate the kind of creative inspiration. So it's a really different experience now because, you know, there's myself and a couple other comics people. And then on the other half of the space, which is like not divided in any way, it's just, you know, we walk past each other all the time. There's these guys working on games and they're very similar practices in terms of story development. So we kind of like, we walk by each other's whiteboards and kind of like sit together to have sort of narrative meetings. So we're kind of like, they're in a very early stage of production with their games. So it's a lot of story stuff that we can kind of help.
But it's a little bit of a game recognizes game. You're like, I see you with your storyboards. I know what you're doing.
Yeah, totally. This doesn't work.
I know.
Like,
yeah, I know what process you're on, and that ain't going to happen. That's an act two that does not work.
Exactly.
That's the first place my mind went is like, oh, that sounds great. A narrative meeting. They all sit down. They're having coffee and they're talking. But the first moment that somebody walks up to and says, well, that second act is completely all wrong. There's got to be a little tension there. In other words, you've got to establish a safe area to do that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah,
I think we're all kind of, I mean, some of us have just met, but we're all pretty much friends. And I think there's kind of a healthy environment of criticism, you know? Mm-hmm. So like they solicited help from us specifically for their second act because they had a beginning to this game and an ending. And they were like, we got, you know, because games are tough because they're like, they've got to worry about actual gameplay and like forking narrative paths and all these crazy, you know, conversation branches.
Right.
And so I tried to just take a broad view of it and say like, look, here are a couple things based on where you're starting, where you're finishing. Here are a couple things you could do just story-wise to like have, you know, some major, you know, just major points like ABC points to get you from start to finish.
Yeah. It is interesting though, how with creatives, even creatives that respect one another, like if I email or call Brad and be like, Brad, I'm stuck. I need 10 ideas quick. Or Brad, what do you think? Help me punch this up, right? And Brad's like, bam, I'm ready to do it. All sorts of stuff. But then there's another thing where I'm like, hey, Brad, check this out. And he goes, that's good, but... And there's a party that's like, I wasn't asking for notes. I don't want notes. Don't give me notes.
Well, isn't part of it It's not that, you know, you're appreciative that someone's got a better idea, but it's like your brain kind of checks it off as finished at some point. And as soon as you have to make edits here, you're like, oh, God damn it. Like, I know I gotta. And you don't know what that one change is going to affect down the line. Like, it's like dominoes.
Yeah.
You know, you change something in your second act and you're like, or your first act. God forbid.
It's like you've buttoned it up like you think like the dishwasher cycle is done. So you start unloading and someone goes, there's one dish, and I'm not going to tell you which one it is. There's one dish that's still dirty in that dishwasher. You're like, wait, what? I got to go back and check everything? Yeah.
But part of that process is it's electric, you know? Like it's this amazing, I mean, you guys know, it's just it, like the process of writing or creating anything is just this constant love-hate. You're just this self-loathing mixed with, you know, personal validation.
Yeah. That's
and
a really
like,
good
it just
way to
never
put it.
Ends. And I guess if it did, it would be boring, right?
Yeah, the highs and lows of that, there are, when you reach the serotonin levels, when you reach the peak of creativity, when you're like, everything is firing, and I'm good at what I do, and what I'm producing is great. And then literally an hour later, I'm the worst. God, I'm a fraud. None of this is holding together. This is all spit and baling wire. Everyone's going to see through it, you know, that kind of thing. So let me ask you, because you're doing two stories, but I want to ask you the timelines and the deadlines for how you work.
Mm-hmm.
Because producing a scheduled regularity, a regular book is one of the trickiest things in comics. So how do you handle your schedule? How do you and your team handle your schedule? Give me the rough outlines of how that works.
Okay, so we aim to do 5 issues a year, which is one trade paperback. So we figure, I mean, I've kind of given up on the idea of doing like monthly direct market comics for a number of reasons that we could get into. But my like personal goal and our team's personal goal is really just if we can do one collected book a year, then we're happy. So if those five issues come out monthly or if they're our first year was monthly, our second year we did bi-monthly just to give ourselves a little more more space to work on it. And I don't know that it really affects sales all that much on an issue-to-issue basis, but the goal is just to have a collected book at the end of each year. So once we know that, we just kind of like Brendan and I break down the story kind of on a chapter, like overall chapter level. And then we break the issues from there. And then our actual issue to issue writing is pretty loose. Like we kind of talk it over on the phone and just figure out where we're starting and finishing. We'll have like a, like 20 page beats and we'll just have loose notes about that. And then I pretty much just go and start drawing it, and I'm kind of writing as I draw also and changing things. And then as I finish stuff, I send it off to Michelle, who's coloring it. And then we have color meetings about that. And then Brendan and I kind of do a final script pass, or really an initial script pass, because we haven't actually scripted anything yet. We do a pass. We it's kind of interesting, really. We overwrite like crazy when we're scripting it. And then we send it off to Aditya Bidikar in India, who's our letterer, who's amazing. He letters it, and then we get it back and we read it. And at that point, we're just editing it. Because usually what happens is we cut about 60% of what we wrote. Because it's all.
You edit it after he's lettered it?
Yeah, which is kind of not great for him, but mostly he's cut. I mean, we're super apologetic.
Yeah. It's a damn good thing he's all the way in India. Yeah. If he was any nearer, he might.
I don't know about you guys, but I can't edit it until I see it together. Like, I can't edit it on on the written page. Mm-hmm. You know, like I have to look at it and then see that. Oh, like a ton of this is redundant. Like this just worked visually, and we don't need all this. Gotcha. This sort of exposition.
I see what you mean. I don't do it to the extreme that you do, but I do. I have to admit, Carl, that some edits can't happen until all the pieces are in place, and then you go, "Oh well, no. I mean, this panel is self-explanatory. I don't need any of this." Or you draw it and you go, "Well, my drawing did not execute in the way that I anticipated that was going to execute. So let's put a little explanatory, you know, something on there." Yeah. A little zhuzh. Well,
a lot of this is really my fault because I don't thumbnail anything. Like I just start, like I go page to page, and I'll like rough out a page and often finish it before I move on to the next page. So like an idiot. Like I don't have an overview of the whole story kind of with word balloon spacing and even rough dialogue beforehand. Like I just always hated that thumbnailing process. Mm-hmm. And so I just go page to page and it ends up, you know, being what it is. And I have to edit stuff later.
So now my question is, you were talking about putting out those monthlies or bi-monthlies, putting out the floppies before the trade paperback. Do you ever foresee a time when you skip that entirely and just go straight to the trade without the monthly floppies?
Yeah. And this is interesting, just business stuff. Like I just talked to Brendan and Michelle about this on the phone the other day, because we're always, Michelle, our colorist, is usually would love more time. And she actually said, like, asked on the phone the other day about whether we could just skip these issues. And my answer was that I have no problem with that. I'd love to do that. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, until we're losing money on those issues, it doesn't make sense to not do them, because they allow us to actually pay. Like Brendan and I make almost nothing off of those issues, because you know how the image deal works,
right?
Vaguely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we print those books and we're not getting a page rate or anything.
Right.
So we just make whatever the profits are on those issues, but we'd still have to pay Michelle and Aditya. So doing those monthly issues allows us to do that and make a little bit, but it's the way attrition works on direct market month-to-month issues. You know, it won't, I'm predicting that our third arc, you know, somewhere, you know, mid arc three or end of arc three will be just at the point where it's not worth doing them at all. Mm-hmm. And we'll just have to spend the year doing our trade paperback. And those will go directly to comic stores and bookstores, which is great, but we'll have to, you know, just figure out a way to pay our, you know, colorists and letterer.
Right. That's interesting, though, to see you in real time planning out the death of that, for lack of a better phrase.
Right.
That's interesting that you're already thinking, well, 18, 24 months from now, somewhere around there, we're going to have to move on to a different model.
Well, I'm also, well, first of all, I've seen it go down with Brendan's other book, Motor Crush. And I've watched my studio mate, Andy Belanger, and Becky Cloonan's Image comic called Southern Cross. I mean, I looked at their numbers as we were prepping our book, just to get an idea of the business. And right. I watched that, unless you're, like in any publishing industry, or I guess any creative industry, if you're not in the top X percent, then your sales are dwindling. If you're not Saga or mm-hmm. Walking Dead, basically, your sales are going to be steadily dwindling. And Motor Crush did go to a format where they had to go straight to trade. Right. So I've sort of been anticipating it for a long time. And also, I kind of also come from this sort of DIY webcomics world, which I love.
Right.
And my preference from the start has always been to, like, if it was up to me, I would have this whole book online for free.
Mm-hmm.
And
really?
still printing it. But I can't, I mean, I maybe could do that. I haven't had that conversation with Image, but I suspect that, you know, they would probably not be for it. And I don't want to compromise that relationship yet, but I do have in the back of my head, like, we've got, you know, with two trades out, like, I might just put the whole first trade up online.
That it's my place to say anything, but you might want to broach the conversation if this is something you're interested in, just because I have found more than most that Image is at least willing to consider mm-hmm. new stuff. Don't you think, Brad?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in the sense that they know the writing's on the wall when it comes to floppies. They must. They see their numbers. And so they're desperate to figure out a new model to get this to work for them. You know?
Yeah. They definitely have their eye on books. I mean, out of all the major North American comics publishers, like, Image has the best bookstore strategy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, they've got a lot of stuff that's easy to read, like short series, things that are not, like, there's no confusion in their bookstore lineup. And they seem to, like, in fact, I believe, you know, the Image deal, like, they when you're publishing your issues, you pay a flat fee up front, and then you keep all the creative rights, and then anything that you make after that is yours. But they do take, I think, 20% off of your trade sales.
Oh, I see.
Which I didn't know until I started publishing. They don't take anything off the issues, but they do take money off the trade. So I'm sure that's where they're making their
right.
You know, they're running. I'm sure Walking Dead is basically paying for Image production.
At this point, it probably is paying for every. Yeah. And what's interesting about that is between Saga and Walking Dead, they have made, it's not the right phrase to say it culturally, but they're in the Barnes and Nobles, the Costcos, the, mm-hmm. you know, and so that's a margin that Image just can't get from comic book shops, don't you think? And
right.
and a distribution level that they just can't get at comic book shops.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And okay, Amazon,
well,
let me
switch gears, because I wanted to ask you. You, among all my friends and peers, are one of the best at streaming your drawing. Your process and the way you do it is incredibly enjoyable. You have created a whole framing system. You've created a whole picture-in-picture for the framing system. It's basically, for those not familiar, it's basically a transparent, probably, I don't know, what do you have, a transparent TIFF or something, or a transparent JPEG?
Or PNGs or something.
PNG or something, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you throw it up, and it creates a framing system so that you can see his drawing in one frame and Carl's picture-in-picture in another frame, and then data streaming on the side. But I wanted to ask you, you clearly got that from gamers that do it really well and for a living. Mm-hmm. But what is your philosophy of streaming? Because an artist doesn't have to stream, mm-hmm. but you not only do it, you do it really well and you make it very pretty. So what is your philosophy for why you do it and how you do it?
Oh, man, I wish I knew anymore. Like, I haven't streamed in this. I think I've streamed maybe a couple times since I came back from overseas.
I was
going to
say, since your move, you've done it less, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. You're readjusting. And then, for God's sakes, the world is falling apart now, so we're all readjusting.
I mean, I'm home now, so I guess I could, but then I'd have a lot of kids running around. My philosophy about it, I don't know. I think I just, I saw it as initially as a way to, first of all, I started doing it, it was like Andy and I in the studio were split screening it. So we'd have, so that was fun. Like the idea was just to kind of have a virtual studio online, and there weren't a lot of comics people at all on Twitch at the time. Right. So when we started doing it, literally within a day, Twitch people reached out to us and said, "Hey, this is amazing. Do you guys want to do like," basically they were, offering us, I don't remember what the tiers are, like there's Twitch affiliates and whatnot.
Right.
But they were interested. They were interested in building up an audience for that kind of thing because it was so gamer centric and, and we were into that too. But then, very quickly, a lot of people, like basically the bottom line is like Jim Lee is on Twitch now. So I have no,
like my specialness audience, has worn off.
I have no clout on Twitch anymore as a comics guy. And you know, just as an aside, like if young me, if I had the access to watch Jim Lee drawing live on Twitch, like that's an incredible resource. Like it's amazing that he does that at all.
Oh yeah. But I just to your credit, I feel like there is an aspect of cartooning that can be made performative, and streaming is the great way to do it. And you just do it really well. So if I'll just say this to the world, if you happen to see on Carl's Twitter feed that he's streaming, go check it out because it's really something special. I frankly, Carl, learn something every time I watch you stream drawing, and I find it really enjoyable. So
that's good. Thank you.
Be that take that for whatever it's worth.
I think it's never, you know, it's hard to keep morale up with a stream like mine, because like for myself, because it's because the viewership is pretty low, like lower than I would have guessed going into it. And I attribute that to the fact that I'm just doing like journeyman. I'm just drawing my page for that day. Yeah. You know, like I'm not doing fan art for the most part.
Right. Right.
I'm not doing I'm not doing known characters. I'm not doing like anything like even colorful, like color would help. Like I'm generally just inking stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing especially like titillating. Like if you look at the stuff that does well on Twitch, it's all, you know, it's obvious what does well. So it's hard to kind of go in there and be like, all right, here we go. Like I'm just gonna talk to these 12 people.
Don't you find though, Carl, that the people that do catch it, for them, it's an incredibly special experience. When I go to shows, people are coming up like, oh yeah, well, I saw the stream of that one drawing, and that was, you know, and you can tell that it means a lot to them.
Yeah.
In a way, for you, it was another workmanly page, but for them, it was like, oh, that was really neat that I got to see you draw that. That was really special, you know?
Yeah, totally. And I don't take it for granted. It works both ways because, like, I got to say, like, those 12 people who tuned in, like, a few times a week or whatever, when I was in Japan, like they were like the only people I talked to all day. Like they were like I'd be working and like I had actual, you know, like they were important relationships. And like a lot of those people are still on Discord and I talk to them. Actually, one of those guys is like had just joined our studio because he just moved from Ottawa to Montreal. So it's worthwhile just for human interaction. I learn a lot of stuff. Some of them are super helpful, like whether it's like in like for artistic resources or technical help.
Yeah, yeah. It is funny though, cartoonists, the original social distancers. We've been doing that since high school, everybody.
It's a Twitter meme now, right? Like everyone's just posting about how they're how like no change for me.
Well, let me ask you as one final question before we let you go. So I have for decades, I think it's decades now, at least a decade, been in love with your Abominable Charles Christopher, which is a story that I find both a visually delightful, endearing, adventurous, and I just think it's the full package. I love that story. But I want to ask you, in your Sophie's Choice world, if you're allowed to pick only one title, which one do you go with at this moment in your career?
Oh, Charles Christopher.
Really?
For sure.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I have other stuff that I'm kind of working on and I've got on the back burner that I'm kind of trying to write, but the Abominable stuff is really like, I don't fully understand what it is, you know, like it's like this weird outlet for me. And it's the only thing, like if I had to finish one thing that I could leave behind for my children, like it would be that because it's the purest essence of my character, I think, or my personality.
Right. It it also that I know that I said that that was going to be my last question, but now I have a follow up question. Who's good at interviewing everybody? So with Abominable and both with Isola too, you have an amazing capacity for capturing the very specific geometry of animals and the shapes and forms that animals take and the look, the very specific looks that they have in both stories. And so I want to ask you, what is your go to reference for animal? Animal reference, animal photography, animal video. Do you go to a zoo? Do you check out videos online? Do you look for? Do you have a particularly good photo reference that you look through? Because your animals are spot on.
Oh, thanks. No, mostly just like a Google image search. If I'm like when you're drawing a lot of, well, I guess for the Abominable comic, it's a lot of Canadian wildlife, right? So like I grew up kind of out near some woods and my dad hunts. So I just was, you know, I would just see animals all the time. And if you kind of know like a quadruped body, whether it's a dog or a cat or whatever, you know, you just kind of get used to it. But if I'm, tigers are really tough actually. Like if I'm having trouble with certain angles, I'll just do an image search for whatever I need. And usually I'll reference it once or twice and then try to not use a reference because I feel like if you look at the early Abominable comics, like they're kind of too accurate. You know, mm-hmm. It's not until I stop using a reference that they sort of become more anthropomorphic and take on more human character. Like basically the flaws creep in.
Right.
And
right.
I kind of cartoon it more, which
and that's where all the personality is in those mm-hmm. flaws.
Yeah. Right. I think, yeah. I mean, I like the later stuff better because of that, because it gets more, you know, it has more of an exaggerated look to it.
The mm-hmm. the downside for me is that that's also the way Brad describes my face, is he says that's the personality comes through in the flaws. And I'm like, all right, Brad, you don't need to tell my mother that. Let's get you and off
he's
the
got,
phone.
I mean, we're on screen right now. He's got a lot of personality.
I think Brad, on behalf of both of us and the audience, yes. I want to thank Carl for coming on. Carl, this is really, really nice of you. It was delightful to talk to you. And once again, for the world, you'll want to check out abominable.cc. And abominable, just in case, because it's a trickier word than most in English. So A-B-O-M-I-D-A-B-L-E.
Nope.
No, you're wrong. You're wrong.
I think that was a bomb and double.
We couldn't have planned that one any better.
Oh my God! All right, Carl, this is okay. A great opportunity for Carl go. To do it right.
It's
it is
A B. Oh man, I hope I don't screw it up. No, it's A B O M I N A B L E. .cc.
Abominable. Abominable.
Have you ever been tempted to secure the rights to the misspellings of that and just forward it?
Yeah, I'll just buy that as a board. It's probably like the .com is probably available for abominable.
Yeah.
Wait, it's abominable, not abominable.
Yep,
abominable.
I am an old ass man, and I've been saying it wrong for decades.
Time to crack out those Webster's dictionaries.
That I am so glad that we are friends, because in an awkward moment, that would have been a terrible thing to have misspelled your URL. All right. Well, then also you could check out Isola at Isola. I got that one right. I know I got that one right.
Isola.ca. My question is, when are you going to start doing something that we can find that isn't going to throw me into fits trying to spell it?
Yeah, even my last name is
simply spelled next, okay?
Yeah. Kershaw is not even easy.
No, none of this is easy.
Carl's next upcoming story is ball or cat. We need to get him a Dick and Jane primer. Like, pick any word in that book, and that's what your title is. There we go, Carl.
Yeah.
That'll be my hourly comic this year.
Well, at any rate, go check out abominable.cc and isola.ca. And Carl, we thank you so much for being on the show, and continued success with all your great work.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Carl. So, Dave, this came across my Twitter feed not so long ago, and I'm really intrigued on where you're going to fall on this little scale here.
Okay.
And basically what this tweet did was it said that there are two schools of thought. One school of thought is kind of like what I'm going to call the KFC school of thought, right? You do one thing.
What, give everybody food poisoning? Is that the KFC school of thought?
No. Not that. And We don't want KFC's
That's
lawyers on
their unstated
on our
goal, not their stated goal. So,
right,
yeah.
Right. No, their motto was, you do one thing and you do it right.
Oh, we do chicken right. Sorry, yes, okay. Right. What an unhelpful co-host you have, Brad. I'm sorry.
So that's on one side. It says, do one thing and get really exceptionally great at that one thing. On the other side, it says it's actually better to be good at a number of things, like, for example, to be good at one, two, or three things than to be exceptional at one thing. And what they say is every time you add something that you're good at, like better than average, in other words, is what we'll define as good. Every time you're better than average, you're good at a task or a thing or an area. Every time you add another good to your list, it's actually better than being exceptional at one thing. And I want to ask you, if you had a choice, would you rather be exceptional at one thing or good at a small number of things?
Brad, this is a fun topic because you know how you have a few arguments in your life that really stick in your brain?
Yeah.
And become sort of seminal moments of how you form your opinions?
Yeah, mine was taste great, less filling.
So, by the way, neither of which was true about that beer. I have a very strong memory of driving from the west side of Los Angeles to the downtown Los Angeles with David Mauchy, the fantastic creator of Wondermark over at Wondermark. Wondermark.com, and also the creator of Machine of Death and a bunch of other projects. Anyway, whenever I bring up this argument with Dave, he's like, yeah, I don't remember that conversation. But for me, it was a really important conversation because we were arguing on the half an hour drive whether it was better to become a really good cartoonist and then branch out, or to become really good at many things and have all of them be the rising tide that lifts the boat, right?
Right.
And so I came down on the fact on the thought that you have to be good at one thing. Get really good at that and then use that platform, that position of publicity or power or however you want to say it, to transition into other things. And Dave was strong in the opinion of like, no, I have interest and I have a willingness to do many things at once. I would like to keep doing many things at once. And in so doing, they will each inform the other artistic endeavors I want to do or business endeavors I want to do. And each will learn from the other and I will lift my boat that way, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And here is the thing that I have learned with more experience. Both in their own way are valid.
Yeah.
Because my career succeeded, Dave Mauchy's career succeeded.
Yes.
And we both ended up doing multiple things and we both ended up excelling in cartooning, right?
Yes.
So both can be true. I think a little bit, it depends on the balancing act you have to do with creativity, not getting stale in what you're doing, keeping your mind invigorated, expanding your knowledge base that informs both your business and your art side. And so all of those can be true. You can go heavily focused on one thing, or you can do, the many smaller tasks in order to lift all of them up slowly over time. Brad, what are your thoughts on this? This is a fun one to talk about.
Yeah, I like this. You know what? I'm going to say it may be a little bit different from you, but much in the same vein. My career, when I look at it, I got very good at one thing and pretty good at a number of others. And that's what kind of buoyed me throughout. In other words, I was really pretty good at one thing, doing the comic, we'll say.
Right.
I got really good or got better and better over time at doing comics. But then I also had to be good at, I had to develop skills to not to be great, but to be just good enough at things like publishing and social media and a number of other task-oriented things. It wasn't important that I become the greatest social media promoter of all time. It just was important that I became good at social media.
Serviceable,
I never put as much time or effort into it as I put into comics, but I needed to get pretty good at it.
Right.
And that's how it kind of went throughout. And if you're gonna kind of focus in just on the creative, certainly I focused on one certain type of comic, but then I also found it really good, much as you're saying, Dave, when I did Fables, which was more like a journalism comic, the experiences I had doing that fed my ability to do other types of comics and gave me a richer understanding of comics in general. Right. When I did single panel comics like Courting Disaster, doing that gave me a better understanding right. of right. how to do other types of things. In other words, everything that I did made me better at the other things I was doing.
Right. You folded it in. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of veering towards the be good at a lot of things, although I think you've got to be a little bit more good at one of them.
Yeah, you're right. And part of it is, you know, we all have to put in that fabled 10,000 hours to get to master a task, right? So if you're comfortable that your 10,000 hours might take you a little longer if you do a couple of projects at once, but by doing a couple of projects at once, it keeps you sane, it keeps you creative, it keeps you doing it, then by God, go that path. That's fine. No one will judge you. That path worked very well for David Mauchy, and I'm super admirable of his career. Mm-hmm. Or if you're like, by God, I got to get my 10,000 hours, and I really want to get good at this one thing first, and then I'll branch out, i.e. like directing a comics documentary in year 10 of your cartooning, then you can go my route, and that worked fine for me, right? So I think... So let me break it down a different way.
Yeah.
We are entering a period that's going to be tricky for all of us for the next 2 years, right? Mm. It's going to be hard financially. It's going to be hard emotionally. But here's the thing. Brad always says, do whatever it takes to get you to the next page. Keep going, right? So that is the mark of success. And if doing multiple creative projects keeps you going, keeps you moving, great. As a friend, I salute you and I say, good for you. If doing one project keeps you sane, keeps you creative, keeps you making pages, then great, do that way. I, as a friend, I salute you and I say, keep going, you're doing great.
Yes.
Whatever it takes to keep creating in a way that keeps you happy, healthy, and sane, and emotionally balanced, then do that. That's fine, and no judgment on it. Don't you think, Brad?
Yes.
Whatever keeps you going in a happy way, in an emotionally balanced and sane way, then do that that works for you.
So much of the secret of success isn't really finding a secret of success. It's finding out what you call success. That's
right.
That's the real secret of success
is
finding out what is success. And once you figure out that your success is going to be completely different than my success, and my success is different than Dave's, and Dave's is different than, you know, someone else's, everyone's got their own version of success, and everyone's version of success is perfectly valid and is right for them and doesn't need to be right for me or anybody else. So much of this means understanding who you are as a person and as a creator.
Right. Right.
And all this time that we spend trying to compare ourselves to someone else. In other words, I could compare myself to someone like Dave Mauchy and say, oh, geez, I could never do as broad of a range of creative endeavors as he's done. Right. He's done a wide range of things that are really fascinating. I can't do that. Well, I guess I'm never going to be successful. No, that's not how success works at all. It's got to be, you've got to determine for yourself what success means for you. And then and then you can actually be successful. Once you determine what success is, then you can start working towards it. But you can't do that if you're working towards Dave Kellett's version of success.
Yeah, it's not. Another way of putting this is that designing a career is not monolithically copying someone else's career or someone else's model. It's more akin to a salad bar. Like, I like the way that Brad has done this. I like the way that David Mauchy has done that. I like the way that Dylan McConis has done this. I like the way that Lucy Bellwood has done that. I like the way that Danielle Corsetto has done this. And so you take bits and pieces from people that you admire, from people that you'd like to model how they did it, and you work it into your creative flow and your creative career. And so there is no one path to the mountain here, I guess is another way of saying it.
Yeah.
You can do my model and focus on one thing and try to get the best you could be at it and then branch out. Or you can do the Dave Mauchy, Brad Geiger model, which is like dabble in a couple things that keeps your heart happy and keeps you creative and keeps you moving. And both are valid because, as I said before, the proof is in the pudding. David, Brad, and I all succeeded and all have become good at multiple things, frankly, different things, but multiple things. And we've all maintained a level of happiness and joy and creativity, even through hard days, dark days, depressing days. So I think whatever model and path works better for you is is the totally valid one, frankly.
That's kind of, you know, sometimes words give us away, nomenclature gives us away. Sometimes we tend to, in our society, we tend to laud the person that's really good at one thing. And then we've got phrases like jack of all trades, master of none, right?
Right.
But if you're that second type of person and you like to do a wide range of things, give yourself the authority to become a dabbler. Be a dabbler. Be a dribble drabble dabbler, if that's what you're going to be. But be whatever it takes for you to be successful.
Yep.
And if that means dabbling, then dabble.
And I will also say this, because it always bears repeating. Be kind to yourself. As you go forward in either the monolithic path of doing one thing and doing it really well, or doing many things very well, there's going to be ebbs and flows in your mood and in your ability to self-support and to reinforce for yourself that you're a good artist and a worthy artist. So just be kind to yourself, regardless of what path you are doing. And if you maintain the joy in the process, as Brad says, that's what a key part of success that is if you have the joy and if it's bringing you peace and comfort and excitement and creative energy, then that's the right path for you. So both Brad and I wish you well, regardless of which path you go, and good luck with it. So actually, Brad, that leads me into, I wanted to read one of our thanks for the kind words. And this
did we get some kind words?
We got some kind words. And for once, it's not from my sweet mother. So here we go. No, this was a rating over at iTunes. And is it even called iTunes anymore? I don't know.
Apple Podcasts, if you want to be among the
Grandpa over here podcasting. Is it still called a LiveJournal? I'm not sure.
Anyway. Is it a phonograph?
No one on Friendster will friend me. This one comes in from Will Ryan, and Will writes, comics can make you better, and this podcast can make your comics better. Brad and Dave find a way to make listening to people talk a visual craft hilarious and informative. Comic Lab has quickly become my most anticipated podcast every week. If you're interested in how to make a comic book or a web comic, as well as laugh your way through learning, this is the show for you. Bradley J. Geiger, how do you feel about those kind words?
Man, that's, you know what? That's going to get me through another week of opening boxes and seeing if I can find stuff that I packed 4 months ago. I got to tell you that, honestly, that stuff makes me feel really good, because I like to know that the stuff that you and I are doing here is making a difference for people. And that's just fantastic to hear.
Well, and also, not to sound cheesy, but I love that there's the joy comes through about talk, because I love talking comics and I love talking comics with you. I mean, I say this before, but we are not digging ditches here. Creating comics is a joy-filled process, and I'm so glad that some of that joy and hilarity can come through the podcast. So thank you, Will, for that. Brad and I appreciate it so much.
Yes, absolutely. And that means, Dave, if you're paying close attention, that means that I get to say this about you. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your host, Sabren, my well-moved-in friend, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my good friend, Dave Kellen, co-director of Stripped and the upcoming Storyline series. And what's the URL for that again?
Storylineshow.com. And I think based on when this podcast would come out, we're on the last week here for Storyline Show.
This is going to be, I really want to see that thing happen. And cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com. Have we revealed who that secret interview is going to be yet?
You know what, Brad? I think we can do it. The secret interview is Brad Geiger, everybody. It's Brad Geiger.
Now you want to see this. Listen, I got dressed up. I got dressed up in my best Jerry Lewis attire.
We had scotch. Yes. It was great.
We got to tell that story sometime, because I don't think I've even told you. Since I was the second to go on, and I'm sitting there watching the other person that you were interviewing and watching him do so well, I just started drinking more and more. So by the time I got up there, I was pretty well lit.
Yeah, the sound guy had to turn your mic down.
Did he really?
No, I'm kidding. Anyway, that's over at storylineshow.com, and I think we're in the last week now based on when this podcast will come out. But the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode.
And with thanks again to Wacom over at WACOM.com and the makers of Wacom One for their sponsorship of the show this week, Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab. Right, Mr. Geiger, where do you want me to put these evil ink not suitable for work boxes? Hold on, let me just put this down and have a look here. Oh, gosh, be galling! Oh, Mother of Mary, what is this? Oh, ta-ta-ta! Seamus, Aiden, Brendan, come here, come have a look at this. This man is a cartoonist, but I've never seen cartoons. This isn't Heathcliff. This is not Heathcliff.
This is definitely not Heathcliff.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, boy.
Yeah, in the words of Smurfette, I think I blew it.
What? What? God, a 2 Smurf jokes in 1 episode. Oh. Oh.